Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here this week with Russ Chianelli as the co-host, and we're going to be talking to a professor of biology who holds perhaps the world record for the discovery of new species of reptile. 150 new species discovered by this one gentleman. And you think, well, where does he live? Does he live in the Mato Grosso? I mean, he's got to be, you know, but no, he lives outside of Philadelphia at Villanova University, where he's a professor of biology, and his name is Aaron Bauer. Aaron, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks very much.
Aaron, tell us a little bit about how did you get into this field? Were you finding reptiles in your backyard on Long Island?
Not too many, but I actually was very lucky. I grew up on an estate. My grandfather was the caretaker of one of these big old Long Island estates. Actually, it had been owned by one of the relatives of a previous governor of the state. And I grew up on this estate 20 miles from New York City, but on 64 acres of open land. And as a kid, I went out and I collected snakes and turtles. And the one thing we didn't have on Long Island was native lizards. And so, of course, I became interested in lizards because it was the one thing that I couldn't get. I could get frogs and salamanders, but I couldn't get lizards.
And when you found your first lizard somewhere else, did you bring it back and sort of transplant it into Long Island?
No, I had better sense than that, I think.
It's not infested with lizards.
No, I went to Florida when I was 9, I think, and that's where I first saw a lizard in where it should be, a lizard in the wild, so...
Well, I've got friends who regularly take some grass snakes back to Ireland simply on the principle that they just think they ought to be doing this. So you didn't have that bad habit.
No, I didn't have to undo the work of St. Patrick either. So
right, it was, yeah. And your parents, they enjoyed this interest that you had in nature?
Well, I always felt that I was very lucky because nobody told me that there was anything wrong with this, and nobody ever discouraged me or said that you can't make a living doing this. And so I made up my mind when I was 5 or 6 years old, this was what I was going to do for a living. I was going to work on reptiles.
Wow.
And at 5, you actually found something in your backyard that you remember?
I distinctly remember it was a green snake, which there really aren't many bright green snakes in North America. And so this one really stood out. I had collected other things at the age of 4 or 5, but when I saw this green snake, I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Did you take it and put it in a jar near your bed or something like that?
No. I held it for a little while and then I let it go.
You take photographs? I mean, do you have records of all these things? As a 4 or 5 year old is very early to be doing this sort of collecting and studying.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm a lousy photographer. I do tend to take pictures of things, but they're more sort of diagnostic pictures. Just sort of here's a record that this was here, rather than something that's nice and
pretty. It reminds me too, because I was probably about your age. I was in Connecticut, and I saw one day this head hissing at me, a copperhead. You know, with a rattle and everything like that. Did you ever be scared as a kid by a rattlesnake?
No, never ran into them as a kid on Long Island. But when I moved to Pennsylvania, I certainly got lots of phone calls from people who thought that they had copperheads or thought that they had rattlesnakes, which almost invariably turned out to be harmless water snakes. But
so Russell's rattlesnake in Connecticut could have probably been something totally different.
Well, there are rattlesnakes in Connecticut.
No, I remember it very well. I mean, I was about the same age, and its tongue was hissing at me, and its tail was up going like this. No mistake. It's the only one I ever saw.
Do you turn around and run? I mean,
yeah,
that's what I'd have done.
I did. No. Back to the house.
So anyway, you're 4 and you're 5, and you're already an established scientist, right? But sooner or later, you had to have an education. Where did you go to school? What did you study?
Yeah, so I ended up going to Michigan State University, where I was studying zoology and history. I was always interested in history as well. And I already knew I wanted to get a PhD, and so I kind of put my nose to the grindstone, and I was in and out of Michigan State in 3 years with a double major, and decided it definitely would be lizards that I wanted to work on, and I also figured out what I wanted to do with them. Up to that point, I just knew I wanted to work with reptiles, but I didn't know what I could do to make a living.
Well, you clearly had to find them.
I mean, I had to find them.
You discovered 150.
But I really got interested in anatomy, and so that was really my first love, was to do reptile anatomy. And then I ended up going to University of California at Berkeley for my PhD, and It was a wonderful place to go with wonderful resources and
yes.
and rattlesnakes in the hill behind campus. And then I started my first real serious research program, which was actually working in the South Pacific.
So let's start from Reptile 101. Let's define for our listeners, what is a reptile?
Okay, well, if we look just at living reptiles, because it gets a little fuzzier around the edges if you look at a lot of fossils, but living reptiles are a group of amniotes, which are a bigger group of animals that lay a particular type of egg or give live birth, but their reproductive style makes them amenable to living in places where there's not much water. So unlike things like amphibians that generally have to have access to water to reproduce, reptiles and their relatives are a group that can survive without that. They're able to reproduce in drier areas, and that probably contributed to their ability to exploit a lot of habitats. And then within that group, a lot of the specifics that make reptiles have to do with features of their anatomy, features of their skull and such. But, of course, people tend to think of them as being scaly, which is true for most, although other things are scaly too. But the group that I work on, lizards, are part of a specific group, lizards and snakes, that are called squamates, and that literally means that they are scaly. And so the scales are probably the thing that people recognize.
They're also cold-blooded, isn't that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, we tend not to like the term cold-blooded because cold-blooded tends to imply that the animals are sluggish, and which is what people used to think a century ago. And in fact, the vast majority of reptiles are able to keep their body temperatures up at a temperature that's the same or sometimes higher than what mammals can do. It's just they're not able to regulate it themselves. They have to rely on external sources of heat to do that. And so a happy lizard is usually a warm lizard, and they warm up by using heat energy from the sun or from the things that they're sitting on.
Sitting on black tar macadam roads.
Right.
Right. Is an iguana part of this family, or am I way off?
Yeah, no. Iguanas are right. Lizards, so they're reptiles too. And
okay, so now tell us, then you've got your PhD, and now you've got your faculty position, and so how do you set about your career? When you finally were an independent young academic and say, I'm going to do this, how do you set about doing it?
That's a difficult question. Well, I guess when I got my PhD, I first went and did a postdoc, actually up in Canada, in Calgary, where it gets minus 40 in the winter, so not a really great place for reptiles. But I started actually working in Africa when I was living in Calgary, and I had worked in the Pacific as a graduate student. And that was really one of the plans in my career was, where are there places that have interesting reptiles that are understudied? Where is it that there's room to work and interesting things to find? And that's kind of where my career has gone over the years, is I've worked in places that needed the work. But I knew had the potential, not necessarily for new species. I don't go out to try and find new species. But I try to go to places where I expect I'll find interesting things or species that haven't been well studied. And that's really what sort of has guided the work that I've done. So starting in the Pacific, moving on to Africa, and then about 15 years ago,
Pacific,
I started working in India too.
When you say the Pacific, you're talking about specific islands or Australia or all of that?
I worked in Australia, New Zealand, and especially New Caledonia. And so New Caledonia had not at that time been studied since the 19-teens. And it had the largest species of gecko in the world and one of the largest skinks in the world. And it was sort of a mysterious place that I knew primarily from collecting stamps. I had these mysterious pictures on these stamps. So I did some of my thesis work there, and really, it's been a gold mine. I've described more than 50 new species from New Caledonia, which is an island about the size of Connecticut.
So let's now be precise of what you mean by a species. Is this something that you have to nowadays have a DNA analysis and look at the genome to make sure? Tell our audience, and me for that matter, what defines a species of these reptiles?
Well, what defines a species? You could do four or five careers out of trying to figure that out. But although there's a lot of kind of philosophical questions about what is a species, from a practical viewpoint, from a viewpoint of a zoologist who's out in the field dealing with animals, you're really looking at a variety of things. And we do use DNA. We do a lot of work in DNA, and that helps to corroborate or helps to verify that we have new species or that we have a different species. But for the most part, that's not how we find them. You know, for the most part, we're looking at traditional anatomical features. We're looking at differences in the scales, differences in coloration, differences in where the animal occurs, differences in the behavior. And if you know the group, if you're working on a group of lizards or a group of anything, and you're familiar with what's already out there and what's known and what's been published in the literature, you often know when you find something in the field that this is something different, this is something new. And then we go back to the lab and we do those scale counts and we borrow material, we borrow type specimens from museums around the world, and we make those comparisons and verify that, in fact, this is different. And usually part of that verification then would, these days, include looking at the DNA as well.
Well, I mean, would you have to have this verified by some third party? I mean, is there a committee that says tick or cross?
Only in the sense that the papers, of course, get submitted to peer review, and right. That's our third party who's giving the opinion there.
Have you had a species rejected, a new one that you thought was very clear, and the referees come back and say, no, no, no?
No, I don't think I've ever had a species description rejected. Occasionally, a reviewer will ask to see some more justification, maybe a bigger sample size, something like that.
Well, also, when you talk about a DNA analysis, I mean, between these species, it must be very subtle and minor.
Well, you know, I work mostly on geckos, and for geckos, it's often the case that very closely related species are still separated by 15 or 20 million years. So in comparison to birds, for example, or people and our closest relatives, closely related lizards are often still very distant from each other. And so you do have substantial differences in the DNA.
Yeah, but you just said something quite interesting, that you said 15 million years. How do you determine the sort of age and when these things arrived?
So there's a couple things we can do, and I try to work on the two major ways that you can do that. One is to use paleontology, which is fairly limited because these are mostly small animals. Although there are bones out there, they're harder to find. They tend to be fragmented. But we do have some important fossils.
So you do the analysis of the samples, the bones of dead ancient things, as opposed to living species?
Well, we in part, we're looking at fossils, and lately we've been looking at a lot of fossils in amber, which are really interesting, really unique sorts of things. We have quite a few new fossils that are 100 million years old from Burma, from Myanmar, and they're wonderful because you're looking into the face of this lizard. It's not just a fragment of a bone.
It's like a time capsule.
It is a time capsule. It's the skin. We have one with the tongue sticking out. I mean, you can see what these animals really look like. So we can date things in part by using paleontology, but we can also date things using a modified molecular clock using DNA data.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russell Chianelli. And our guest today is Aaron Bauer. He's a professor of biology from Villanova University, talking about species of reptiles, which run the gamut from big buggers to little buggers, all the way from iguanas to that little fellow that publicizes Geico. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. In recent years, we've seen the troubling headlines. Kids who committed suicide after being bullied. Some of their parents may be haunted by the question, why didn't I know?
But there are no clear warning signs, unlike a viral or bacterial infection. Yet researchers have identified biomarkers that are linked to suicidal thoughts.
Biomarkers are signals that show up under specific conditions. For example, our bodies produce cytokines to defend against viruses.
In the new study, 75 men with bipolar disorder were followed for thoughts of suicide from zero to high in interviews spaced 3 to 6 months apart. Several proteins in their blood varied with the men's mood swings, but one in particular, SAT1, stood out.
In 9 men with high suicidal thoughts, the protein was elevated. Researchers then tested the blood from 9 men who had already committed suicide and found even higher levels of SAT1.
To further confirm the protein's role in suicide, they took regular blood samples from 40 men with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. The results were consistent. Those with high SAT1 levels were 80% more likely to be hospitalized later for suicidal behavior.
These results look convincing, but they're not conclusive. Many factors affect SAT1 levels, such as toxins and infections, and suicide is a complex mental illness.
It's possible, though, by combining behavioral along with biological indicators, doctors one day could prevent thousands of heartbreaking suicides. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Aaron Bauer, professor of biology from Villanova University, talking about reptiles, sort of a current buzzword is diversity, all right? And clearly, as we get cleverer and cleverer, we're increasing the diversity of species because you're going out and discovering new ones. Of course, that's counterintuitive to the reality out there that we're slowly decreasing the number of species of everything. Tell us, how does your work fit into this? And do you think it's important in your area that we maintain the big diversity of reptiles that are out there? Why is it important?
Yeah, I think that, you know, diversity is really critical to the things that I do, and one of the really important things is people have to realize that if you don't go out and you don't do this kind of work to really pinpoint what you have, any efforts you make to protect things are really pointless, because if you think you have one widespread species and you develop a strategy to try and protect that, that's a very different strategy if it turns out that one species is actually six species, each of which has a slightly different habitat, different requirements. And so if you don't really document the biodiversity, you're ignoring the reality. And anything you try to do about conservation is really a sham. So I would argue that biodiversity discovery is absolutely critical for any type of conservation.
There are people that would suggest, look, things change, and therefore if the odd little purple gecko of the Suwannee River area of Tennessee suddenly becomes extinct, no big deal, because, you know, this is just the way that the system operates. What's the counter-argument to just letting it alone and let things develop as they would normally develop, even including our own interference with their habitat?
Yeah, you know, I mean, at some level, you know, I can understand the argument, because any one species, at least for people, may have very little relevance. But the issue really is the diversity overall. And you don't know in advance what role any particular species might be playing in the environment. The loss of one species may have cascading effects on other species in terms of ecology and in terms of other historical interactions. So we can't really second guess what the loss of something might imply for the environment as a whole or for other organisms. And it's one thing if it's a process that's occurring naturally, but if we're accelerating that process, I think we've got a responsibility to sort of say that we need to do something.
Let me ask the question in a different way. You were saying before, and I know this was true, that you find really preserved species that are extinct in the amber. Everything's there, the DNA, the skin, and everything like that. How close are we to resurrecting an ancient species? It's possible, isn't it?
Well, the difficulty is, you know, the DNA especially is very degraded in these old specimens. And it's been very difficult for people to obtain really usable DNA out of these. Now, occasionally you can out of more recent ones. But there are no really good examples of very ancient DNA, that is, tens of millions of years, that people have been able to really get anything of value out of. And it's also the case with these amber lizards. They look perfect. They look intact, but they often turn to soup inside. And what you have is a little shell of what the animal really was. Occasionally we find them, we are able to X-ray them and do CT scans of them, and you'll have an animal that looks perfectly intact, and the entire skeleton is all stuck in the tail. It's all come apart, rotted away before the animal was completely encased in the amber, and the hard parts of the animal are stuck in the bottle.
It always stuck because around here in El Paso, we have mammoth DNA that people are getting from up in the mountains. And so what you're telling me is Jurassic Park isn't coming around the corner.
No, it's not coming around the corner. It's very difficult even to take material that's 100 or 200 years old. The effort to do that is more than most labs that work with DNA are able to do. You need to do special procedures, and ideally you have to have extremely clean labs because you have so little DNA that a random DNA that you have in the lab from yourself or technicians or students or from a fly or from anything else will probably be more in the environment than the DNA that's left in that specimen. So you have to be really careful.
So that brings up then the issue of how do you do this? Do you have a team study A, another team to do DNA, another one to go back through the records? Is it all within your particular group, or do you sort of outsource to for example, DNA analysis, as you said, clean rooms, very complicated, got to be very careful. Do you outsource that to laboratories that specify and just do that particular job?
Well, we're set up to do DNA work, although not to do this ancient DNA work. So we can do basic DNA sequencing, and my training is really as an anatomist, so we're also set up to do the anatomical work. We can do CT scans. We can do x-rays. We can do a variety of things like that. But in the course of a year, I might collaborate with 100 people in 30 different countries. And so a lot of the work that I do is very collaborative. I just came back from a meeting in New York where I brought in former students and other coworkers from all over the U.S. and from Europe to work on some of these amber fossils. It's often good, even if we don't need somebody else's technology, it's always good to have somebody else's eyes and somebody else's ideas on things. And so a lot of this work is very collaborative.
So your papers will be multi-co-authored. Right? I mean, it's not just you and a graduate student. It's you and a whole team.
It varies, but we certainly have some. I've had some papers where we've had 25 or 30 authors. I mean, most often it's a smaller group of people, maybe three or four people. But depending on the circumstances, we might need to bring in more expertise. Or we bring in people from different parts of the world because we're doing a global study and we need to have material from different parts of the world.
The excitement. Just go back in your memory bank and think, gosh, there was this one particular discovery that we made. And
maybe the first one that was new.
So the first one that was new, that's a good one, and it's a sort of atypical one. It was the largest gecko that ever lived. It was a gecko that was the size of a house cat.
It's extinct.
It's extinct now, probably, but not for very long. This was a specimen. I was sent photographs when I was a graduate student of this large gecko that had been hanging on the wall in a museum in Marseille for 150 years.
And
nobody knew what it was. It was stuffed. It was a taxidermy mount. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody seemed to pay much attention to it for 150 years. And I was going to Europe to do a museum trip to look at other specimens. And I thought, well, let me take a special trip to Marseille and see what this is. And I thought, it must be something that's maybe just a little bigger than a normal gecko, or maybe it's a fake. And when I got there, my jaw dropped because this was a gecko the size of a house cat that had been sitting in public view for 150
this
years.
This was in Marseille.
In Marseille.
Yeah, okay.
Probably was collected in New Zealand because it was clearly a representative of a group that occurs there today, probably by early French whalers working in New Zealand waters before New Zealand was annexed by Britain. And probably some...
Is that the way people think about it? New Zealand being annexed by Great Britain.
Yes, I think so.
I got to rethink my history a little bit, but carry on.
Yeah, but before...
said it was 150 years old, this gecko?
The gecko was probably from around the 1830s.
Right? Yeah, okay.
And so before about 1840, when you started to have a kind of formal colonial structure in New Zealand, this was, it was wide open, the Southern Ocean's wide open for whaling. And probably this was somebody on a ship who thought, I'll bring this back to my hometown museum. And there
so you said 1840?
About 18. The specimen's probably from around
so
the 1830s.
So you found this new species, and then you went to a winery, and you had a bottle of 1840 Oberon.
Right, that, which is the whole point. How do you do the celebration? I mean, around here, you know, if you get a grant or you get a particularly good paper, we all go out and we don't get blitzed, but we have a few drinks. What's your tradition?
I'm probably not very exciting if I don't drink, but I'll have an iced tea or something, I guess, to celebrate. I don't know. I buy a book. I have a big library, and I like books, so I'll celebrate by splurging on a book.
Yeah, it reminds me, though, there must be other things like that in museums around the world, in the storerooms or whatever, you know?
I spend a lot of time in European museums. American museums are less interesting because they're newer and they've been better organized throughout their history and they haven't been disrupted by wars. But I spend a lot of time, especially in German museums, and I frequently find fascinating things. Recently worked with a collection that is probably the oldest collection in fluid, in ethanol, that's around. Specimens date back maybe from the late 1600s. And in Italy, I've worked with Aldrovandi's collection, which is from the 1500s, dry specimens that somehow managed to survive for half a millennium.
So in fact, then, I mean, rather than necessarily having trips into the Matto Grosso or wherever one wants to go next to look for reptiles, the museum collections in the basement, as Russell points out, I mean, storage for hundreds of years. That's a very interesting area.
It is an absolute gold mine. So, you know, most of the species I describe are new species that we've collected in the field, but every year there are new ones from museums.
Places like Carthage or someplace where people back in the Roman era storing things like in a museum like that?
Not much from beyond about 1500. That's the Aldrovandi's collection is sort of the oldest museum in the modern sense, and almost nothing survives from earlier collections, just because they had no way to preserve things except to dry them. And insects primarily have ravaged anything that's older than that.
I'm interested in how you name your new species, all right? I mean, I know people can choose their own names quite often.
Right.
And tell me, do you have a pattern to the naming of your discoveries?
Well, sometimes we're sort of contractually obliged. You know, you work in a particular country and there's sort of an obligation.
And the president would rather like
something. Those sorts of things. But I like it when I can have sort of a double entendre with things. And
right.
So I named a species in South Africa. I named the genus, too. The genus was Hochia, which is often mispronounced Gagia, but it's an Afrikaans word, which means a creepy crawly. And so we named the genus creepy crawly because they're little tiny things. But we named a species Gemula. And we picked this because, one, it was a little gem. It was the most colorful and attractive member of the genus. But, two, it's only found in a diamond mining area. And so I really liked that name because
right.
it sort of hit in two different ways. And so when I can do that, I try to do that.
So is this a collaborative effort too? Do you gather around with your coworkers for this particular species and say, hey, let's just do a think tank and come up with some interesting names?
Sometimes we do. We recently described a bunch of African lizards where we named new genera, and these are sort of like little dragons in the way they look. And so one of the genera that we named was Smaug, that we named after the character, the dragon from The Hobbit. It is a sort of nice, sort of whimsical sort of thing that you get
wonderful.
To do when you describe new species.
And there's no committee that will say this isn't – like in Germany, you know, there's certain names you're allowed to name your children, but there's no – sort of committee, no red guard to say no names like this.
As long as the name hasn't been used before and as long as it's formulated correctly in terms of Latin endings.
Well, who approves this? Is there some sort of name category?
No, just the review process takes care of this. You know,
right.
Some people will have a chance to review the name. And I've never had anybody who complained about a name. It's sort of a sacrosanct sort of thing. It's you as the describer. It's your right. And as long as it's not offensive in some way,
right.
It's yours to name.
Hey, it's been great. Aaron Bauer, professor of biology, Villanova University, named 150 new species of lizard. It's been absolutely fascinating having you here on Science Studio. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And, of course, as usual, I have to say thanks for the audience. Without the audience, there's no program. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech's Paul L. Foster School of Medicine in El Paso now has a Willed Body program. People who donate their bodies help to advance medical research and help train future doctors. The program is open to anyone 18 and older. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Sierra Providence Health Network.